Hi, this is Roland Mann, comic writer and former editor for Malibu and Marvel Comics. You are listening to Mighty Marvel Geeks.
You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
USB microphones and headphones provided by CAD Audio. CAD Audio, expression through innovation.
Forgive the interruption, but I believe this requires your attention.
Meanwhile, at the above-ground underwater suborbital volcano lair...
Sergeant, we need a response team.
We're already putting together the best men. With all due respect, sir, so am I.
I have a plan. It's real!
Mighty Marvel Geeks.
That's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team.
Team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes... chaos. We're a time bomb.
Well then, son, you've got a condition.
Your show about all things Marvel with Mike, Kylan, and Eric.
What a bunch of losers. I am Groot.
That I don't know.
These people may be isolated, unbalanced even, but I believe with the right push, it can be exactly what you need.
Suit up. I'm bringing the party to you.
I have indeed been uploaded, sir. We're online and ready.
And welcome to another issue of Mighty Marvel Geeks with Eric, Mike, and Kylan. Hey, I didn't say Ken like I did a few weeks ago.
That's true.
So
you finally remembered that you upgraded your co-hosts.
Yeah. It's those mental lapse. The tag you heard at the beginning from Roland Mann. Well, guess what? Roland, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing dandy. And yourself?
We're doing great. So I hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. This is the online version. We are not on Sorcerer Radio this week because it's all music. But yeah, it's just... we're going to continue the talk of Malibu and I guess eventually get to the sad part, which was the decline of Malibu.
Mm-hmm. See, we had the happy interview with you last time you joined us. Now we get to the sad part of the story. Yeah.
It was a sad, sad day.
I guess let's recap a little bit of what we talked about last time. Which we did. We talked about how Men in Black came about. Cat and Mouse, was it?
Yeah, and talked about Cat and Mouse some.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, we've got all of that. Where do we go with Malibu from there? I mean, things were going good. Marvel came in.
What did we get to the Image stuff?
I don't think we really got to the Image. Talk about, if you would, like, where really, what's the explosion happened?
Uh-huh.
When it seemed to really be taking off, along with, like, Valiant and Image. And really, just because the early 90s was kind of a, it was a bloom with all these smaller companies. I don't want to say Malibu being a smaller company.
Oh, well, they very much were. Yeah.
Well, they all started out small, but
yeah.
I mean, you had others. You also had Lightning. You had Mile High. No, it wasn't Mile High. It was can't think of now. Well, there's of course the one that I worked for, which was Dagger. But
Crossgen was in there as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Crossgen didn't come along till later, though.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Defiant. That's the
Defiant.
Defiant. That's the ones I was trying to think. I could see the tower, but
did Dark Horse get a start around that time too?
Yeah, Dark Horse started in 1986.
Okay.
So yeah. they were already, you know, kind of full steam ahead. I tell you what, I'll just start yakking about that time, and you stop me if I'm going the wrong way, or if I'm rambling, because I do tend to do that a little bit. Really what happened is, I was a freelancer in 92, and the Image guys were already, making noise, and we already had... I never can remember the sequence in which these books came out, but you know, The Amazing Spider-Man that Todd McFarlane wrote, so you know, sold like 3 million copies, and then something like X-Factor comes along and sells like 5 million copies, and then X-Men comes along and sells like 8 million copies. And I think this was happening in I want to say it may have been 91 this was happening, but this was the Image guys. They were already beginning to sort of grumble and some rumblings a little bit. And I was getting probably, I don't know, 60% of my freelance work from Malibu, and established a really good relationship with those guys. And I was at Atlanta Dragon Con one time talking to the editor-in-chief, Chris Ulm, and I said, hey, you know, how can I get some more, you know, work out of you guys? Because I really liked the relationship, blah, blah, blah. He said, well, actually, we're getting ready to cut back on our freelancers. And I was like, well why? And he said, because we're going to build an in-house staff, creative staff. He goes, we want to model the Marvel bullpen from the 1970s. I'm like, oh my goodness, really? Why don't you bring me out there? You know, because again, I am a mighty Marvel geek, and I'm like, I want to do that. I want to do this. And he's like, and of course, you know, Chris knew me. And he's like, he says, you would leave your beloved Southland? And I'm like, yes, to work in an environment like that, doing something I'd love to do. Absolutely. 2 weeks later, he called and offered me a job, and I picked up and moved to California. And started became an editor out there. Now, by the time I got there, they had already sort of cut the deal with Image, so I wasn't, you know, I wasn't privy to any of that. It was kind of what they had, you know, worked out. A lot of people don't realize this, but Malibu was, I think, the official title, the legal title is called Publisher of Record or Publisher of Note, something like that. And really, all that Malibu did was the business stuff. Image did all of the, you know, they created all the books, they delivered all the artwork, they did all of that stuff, and they just said, okay, look, here, the book is done, Malibu, we don't know what to do with it at this point, you go make it happen. So Malibu did that for about 10 months while Image hired their staff and built their structure. Wow. Yeah, a lot of people don't really, it's only 10 months. Wow. But for those 10 months, all the Image books were channeled through Malibu. Every single, all of the number ones, the Spawns, the Youngbloods, all of that stuff was channeled through Malibu. And again, the reason this was happening is because, you know, the seven founders of Image, they didn't really know what they were doing as far as the business sense goes. And so they just needed someone, hey, look, you handle this while we hire people to do it to become the Image thing. I get out there when this is just, you know, just getting rolling, and I start editing the Genesis line, which of course was Protectors, all the related titles, which included The Ferret, Man of War. I also did The Dinosaurs for Hire, and I did The X-Mutants. Well, it wasn't, but probably 5 months into the Image thing, Malibu says, okay, there's Image. We've got the Dark Horse has just announced that they're going to do this world. Someone else, I forget, Valiant maybe at the time. And Malibu, what I didn't realize, Malibu had already been talking about doing their own world, superhero world. And it was initially called the Megaverse. I forget exactly why we changed. There was something mega coming out.
Well, Palladium Books had the Megaverse back in the late 80s.
That may have been what it was then. But ultimately, it changed to the Ultraverse. And the launch was going to come a little bit later, but Dark Horse announced that they were going to launch theirs in, I forget exactly when. So Malibu said, well, we can't let Dark Horse beat us to the punch. We've got to release ours. And therefore, I think it was July of 93 that the first Ultraverse titles came out. And of course, they did really, really well. Now, what happened after that, though, is obviously, you had the Valiant Universe, you had Defiant, you had Dark Horse. Malibu was about the number three company, depending on what Dark Horse published. Okay, so you had Marvel and DC, and I'm just ballparking these numbers, but Marvel would get about 45%. DC was bringing in about 40% of the market share. Malibu was coming in at about 6 or 7%, thereabouts. And Dark Horse was coming in about 5 to 9%, depending on if they published a Terminator or Predator book. So we were number three if there were no new Predator and Terminator books on the market. If there were Predator or Terminator books, then we were number four.
behind Dark Horse. So yeah, we were, you know, we were kicking butt and taking names, and it was rocking right along.
I got a question about actually. Now, how did the, because let me gather my thought here. The continuity was very tight in amongst the Ultraverse.
Yes.
With a lot of crossing over. It's, you know, a character would be in one book, it'd be in their own book, and then the storyline continue in somebody else's. How much of a logistical, I don't want to say nightmare, but, you know, was it hard to keep everything straight? I mean, if you were editing on one book and say, you know, the characters were going over into somebody else's edited book, was, you know, was how I guess I'm asking, how closely did you have to work with the other editors there just to make sure that there were no continuity errors?
Very closely. We worked very close. We had meetings regularly, and we essentially had a weekly Ultraverse editors meeting where we just sat down and said, okay, here's what's on the table. Obviously, our production schedule was set by not by us, but by the production department, and they basically said, here's when your books have to be delivered, blah blah blah, you know, because I'm sure you guys know they have to reserve printing space, you know, printing time on with the printing presses. And this is why, you know, you can't be late. And so the production department said, here's the schedule. And so we would have to take that. Now that said, the founders, the Ultraverse founders were, incredibly a pretty tight group, early on. There were several meetings with the founders, which they would all, I think the initial meeting was held in Scottsdale. I did not attend that initial meeting because I was still doing the Genesis titles at the time, but after I want to say probably 6 months or so, maybe not even that long, Malibu just decided, look, we like this idea of this world, and the problem is that if we do the Malibu titles, the Genesis, the Protectors, the Dinosaurs for Hire, we're kind of competing with ourselves. So there was resistance. One of the ideas was like, well, why don't we just bring these into the Ultraverse? You know, bring the Protectors, bring the Dinosaurs for Hire, that kind of thing. Well, there's two reasons that didn't happen. The first one was the founders were not really keen on that idea. The founders really didn't want anybody else to play in the sandbox, if you will. And then the second one came from a more practical sort of salesman, idea, is that the marketing department said, well, look, here's the problem. Protectors sell at this level, right? Ultraverse is selling at this level. And now at the time, Ultraverse was, you know, 100,000 plus. Protectors books were around 40,000 to 50,000 copies. And so, you know, there was considerable difference. And so they were saying, we don't want to muddy the waters between the two brands. And therefore, they just decided to cancel all the Ultraverse, but the Malibu stuff. That's when they brought me over to the Ultraverse. But several of the founders lived close to the office, and they were in the office frequently. I mean, Mike Barr, James Hudnall, both of them lived, within driving distance to the office. We saw them, you know, I would like to say once a week, every other week, something like that. I had lunch with them frequently. Steve Englehart lived up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so he didn't get to get down there as much. But I made a trip, you know, more than one trip up to that area to have, you know, conferences with him. Say, hey, what do you want to do? Where are we going with this? So yeah, to answer your question, it was a really tight knit thing. Was it a nightmare? It really only became a nightmare. Initially, you know, some of the early crossover stuff, that wasn't that big a deal. It's like, oh, you know, hey, can we borrow this character for this month? Well, let's, you know, make sure. The two writers would usually, you know, once we kind of went through the processes, the two writers would usually just talk to each other and make sure that the stories jived. As the editors were kind of like, yeah, okay, as long as you're happy, we're happy with this. It really only kind of got to be a nightmare once some of the bigger crossover stuff started to happen.
Were there any particular favorites that the founders had? Like, say, oh, we really like it when Prime comes over with the Strangers or whatever.
Well, it shouldn't surprise you that now, I don't remember the deals. I have a copy of it somewhere. Not handy, but I have a copy somewhere. There were specific deals about cameos and special appearances and things like that. So, for instance, if Nightman had a cameo in Prime, then there was a small little royalty paid to Steve Englehart, and I forget who helped co-create Nightman, but the Nightman creators, for a cameo. Special appearance got a slightly larger royalty, right, for the book. So everybody, yes. Yeah, it was a little, you know, they were kind of like, one of the things that they did is they looked at Marvel and they said, hey, you know, it seems unfair that everybody wants to use Wolverine and all these titles to bolster their sales, and yet the Wolverine team does not get any benefit out of this. You know, Alpha Flight gets a boost when Wolverine shows up in Alpha Flight. Well, that's great for Alpha Flight, but what does this do for the X-Men? And, you know, so this is one of the things that the founders kind of kicked out. Well, like, okay, well, here's what we'll do here. So obviously part of what we had to really rein in early on is like, yes, no, you can't be having special appearances every single month, because, you know, they were all wanting them to let me have a little. The one they wanted, though, was Prime. Everybody wanted Prime because it was the number one selling book. Right. So everybody wanted Prime to show up in the book, in their book, I should say.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I have a question.
Okay.
Because I came into Malibu because of the Bruce Lee miniseries.
Sure.
Which I kept hoping was going to be a full-fledged series, but that never happened. Now, the thing is, I was surprised that you guys, number one, actually got the rights to the Bruce Lee series, and number to Bruce Lee, period. And number two, mm-hmm. it was so well-written. Like, I remember, like, years later going back and rereading that miniseries. And that was like my introduction into Prime. I mean, into Malibu.
Yeah.
So now, with the Ultraverse being, I guess, obviously being the more popular properties, was that? I mean, I guess was there absolutely no interest for anything outside of the Ultraverse after that? Like, is that why? All the Mortal Kombat stuff that you were doing, and any of the other books that were being written, were just phased out, or
fact, the Star Trek books, we did Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Right.
And they were doing incredibly well. They were doing very well. I can't remember some of the other. We had a Mark Paniccia, who is now Marvel editor. He was our licensed property guy, and
right.
his titles were doing great. You know, you mentioned Mortal Kombat. They did the Star Trek books. So here's the thing about Star Trek, which very few people realize. Okay, you know, Star Trek is a Paramount book. Before Marvel bought Malibu, okay, Paramount toyed with the idea of purchasing Malibu Comics. All right, there was a period of time of about 2 to 3 months that I actually thought that I was going to become a Paramount employee, and we were going to become Paramount Comics. I say that I don't think they would have changed. I think we would have always been Malibu, but I think that Paramount would have become the parent company. That was a very real thing, because Paramount at the time, now again, I'm not suggesting anybody's unhappy now, but at the time, Paramount was incredibly happy with the way we handled the Star Trek books, and they were incredibly unhappy with the way DC was handling the Star Trek books, because, you know, we had Deep Space Nine, and DC had just the regular Star Trek. Well, we used to, not me specifically, but, you know, I hear these all from Mark. Mark used to say how they were always so unhappy with what DC did and very happy with what we did, and they were always trying to get us more and more stuff. So, no, we had a really aggressive licensing department.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, it was kind of twofold. There were two things that they were trying to do. Obviously, they were trying to take the Malibu properties and sell them, right?
Right.
We had Protectors had a whole series of toys. Ultraverse ended up doing, when I say toys, I mean like a Nerf gun and stuff like that. Ultraverse obviously had the figurines. They had a cartoon. I should say action figures, not figurines. They had action, a line of action figures.
They're collectibles, man.
Sorry. Hey, listen, at least my mom used to always call them your dolls. Roland, are you going to play with your superhero dolls? Mom, they're not superhero dolls. They're action figures. But she never stopped calling them dolls.
Yeah. It's like, Mom, I'm a boy. I don't play with dolls. Come on. Yeah, so, the intent was never to give up the licensed properties. The whole reason that for the protectors and that stuff was just because it was a superhero universe and it competed directly with Ultraverse, which was also a superhero universe. We also had, I don't know if you remember this, we also had the Rocket Comics, which was the music line, Rocket Comics.
Yes.
Lita Ford, Ozzy Osbourne, Black Sabbath, Pantera.
I have a couple of those. I remember them now. Wow.
Well, if you have Lita Ford, I wrote that one.
I think I do have that one. Lita Ford.
It has beautiful art by Jim Ballant. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah.
I remember that comic. I do not have that comic, but I remember that comic.
Yeah, yeah. It's a gorgeous looking book. Obviously, Jim Ballant's a fantastic artist. It was only the Genesis line, just because it was seen as this is two superhero lines competing within the company, and it just didn't make any sense to do. So we're still gonna we're still planning on marching forward with all the license. Oh, the other thing I say, the license, the department. The other thing that they were really aggressive in trying to do is trying to get us. They were always trying to get us new properties to work on. I mean, just constantly they would come back. What do you think about this? What do you think about this? I mean, I read novels and watched movies. Because they would come back to us. What do you think about this? I can remember one. I wish I could remember the name of it. I may not actually. It may be better that I don't remember. I can remember one. One of the license guys came to me and said, would you read this book? You know, we might be able to get the rights to do this as a comic. And it was Talking Horses. The whole thing was Talking Horses. And I said, here's after I read the book, I said, so here's my thoughts about this. Number one, it's Talking Horses. And I said, how many references are we going to have to, Mr. Ed? And the second thing, I don't know very many artists who like to draw horses. Most comic artists just do not want to draw horses because apparently it's one of those animals that's just kind of hard to draw.
Unless you're an eighth grade girl.
Yeah. And then you put a horn on his head, right?
Yeah, there you go.
You could have done
the start of the Brony movement. My Little Pony presented by the Ultraverse.
That's right, yeah.
A superpowered no.
Careful, Colin. What has been seen cannot be unseen.
I know, that's why I stopped myself.
That could explain the artwork then of a certain artist by the initials of RL.
Oh, no, you didn't.
He did.
Sorry.
He did.
A little long in the tooth there.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so I'm going to ask this question then.
Okay.
All right. All the licensing stuff that got pitched to y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one that stands out in your mind as, man, I wish we had gotten hold of that, but didn't?
I'm trying to think of what we did or what we didn't do. Trying to think of, is there something that we lost? I know that I can remember our guys used to always tell me that they would occasionally bump into some of the Dark Horse folks. I want to say that they actually talked to some people about Terminator. Again, you got to keep in mind that Malibu was killing it in the early 90s
in what
we were doing. And, we were young as far as the company was, and employees too. I mean, we were young, we were agile as a company. We could move quickly, and this is part of the reason that Marvel liked us, is because they were slow. They could not make any decisions quickly. We could make a decision, like that and have something done. So it would have been cool if we could have gotten Terminator. And I know that's something, I don't know how close we ever got to be with that exactly, but I know that there was talk around our licensing office about that. I wish we could have done more with was BattleTech.
We did
a BattleTech miniseries, but I really wish we could have done more with that.
Now, you said y'all were talking with Dark Horse a little bit at the time. Did the Star Wars titles ever come across as a potential?
I don't remember that at all, if it did.
I don't remember that if that was the case. Okay. No, when I say the Dark Horse, what I mean is that our licensing folks would be in some of the same circles. Okay. As the Dark Horse people, because we were very much in good spirited competition with them.
Right.
So they would walk some of the same circles.
Okay.
So y'all were frenemies. Is that what you're saying?
yeah, we were. And you know, the weird thing is, we were kind of frenemies with a lot of folks, except for Marvel and DC before the purchase. You know, to Marvel and DC at the time, we were really just kind of beneath their notice. I guess if you would until Image really kind of changed it all. You know, I mean, you go ahead.
Well, I just remember from when I would go out to trade shows and conventions and stuff like that. Yes, you would have the Marvel and DC guys. They would be the rock stars, obviously, yes, of the comic cons. But you know, the Valiant, the Image, the Malibu, we would all be just kind of like it's almost like it was us versus them.
Yeah, very
to
much
a degree,
so.
And that the us being a very big collective us. It was basically everybody else versus the big two.
Yes, exactly right. So that's why I kind of say the frenemies idea there is that, yeah, everybody except for those guys.
Yeah.
You still think it's that way today?
You know, I would get, if you were to ask me to guess, I would say yeah. That's just a guess on my part. Because you know, Marvel and DC still rule the roost. I mean, they're still the big guys, and even as far as Image has come, you know, they're still considerably less as far as the market share goes. I think it's changing, I think maybe in another 10 years we may be having a different conversation. Part of that is I think because the distribution method keeps changing and affecting comics. You know, when I first was trying to do my own thing, and then after the whole Marvel thing collapsed, when I went to print a book, I had to print a minimum of 3,000 copies, and we're talking about traditional print runs, traditional presses. You know, 3,000 copies. That's a lot of book. I mean, I was, you know, my orders through Diamond at the time were anywhere from about 600 to about 1,400, 1,500, something like that. So you're talking 1,000 copies I had to stick in my garage whenever I would order.
Wow.
A book. Well, today, you can print on demand. You can get a copy, one single copy. Now, it's pricier per unit, sure, but It's changed the market so that a lot of people can actually get out there. I think, and for me personally, I think it's a good thing. You know, I
right.
think we get to see a lot of stuff that that we wouldn't normally get to see.
Well, I think even today you can almost even bypass the physical copy and just go straight to Comicology with the digital.
Yeah.
I think that's having a profound effect on it.
It is. There, you know, about 3 years ago, and I forget who was telling me this, and it's possible that I probably shouldn't tell you his name if I could remember, but I can't remember. I was talking with a guy at DC, and he was telling me that this was just before they went same day digital. And he was saying that they were speculating, you know, because there's no way to really know about the piracy, but they were speculating they were losing 20,000 units per issue per month to digital piracy.
Oh.
Well, yeah, exactly. So listen, I don't do math very well, but if DC publishes 40 books a month times 20,000 copies, that's you know...
That's a boatload of copies.
Yeah, that's a boatload of copies. That's a lot of shrimp and grits. you know, so this is part of why, you know, and it made retailers mad when they first did it. I think they got over it. But part of what they were trying to do is saying, look, you know, we're releasing these paper copies, and then, you know, the pirating is so fast that we're losing they felt they were losing these sales. So they look, we're just going to do same day digital, and, you know, cut down on the piracy, because a lot of people they'll give the money for it if it's available, but when it's not available, they're going to go pirate it. You know,
yeah. And all you need is one person with a flatbed scanner.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just, you know, with a scanner and Acrobat, and they can make a PDF of that one comic, and that's all you need.
So I was, and I want to tell you, I was Googling one time trying to, because I'm trying to take some of my older black and white books and trying to reissue them digitally and everything. And so I said, you know, I wonder how can I, because I don't have all the artwork for it. I have some of it, but I don't have the art. So what's the best way for me to scan these comic books? And so I Googled, you know, scanning old comics. And would you believe I stumbled across these YouTube videos that basically said, here's how you pirate comics. And I'm like, no, really?
Yeah.
Everything's on YouTube.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it really is. Yeah. So, I think, you know, and we probably won't go there, but, you know, if we wanted to talk about the early Image books, we could. I didn't think very much of them as far as quality, but the truth of the matter, Image has really become a game-changing company today.
Right. I'm looking at Diamond Numbers, just pulling out a random date, and this was August of last year.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about dollar share. Marvel had 34.25%. DC had 28.75%. Image had 8.83%.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a huge gap.
That is a huge, huge gap. Then, you know, and even then it falls off considerably from there. You know, you had IDW, which was 5.43, Dark Horse, 4.73.
Mm-hmm.
Anything after that was like 2.5%, 1.5%, that sort of thing. Yeah. So when you figure, you know, 35 and you're talking about 65% roughly of the market share.
Yeah. Marvel
it's
DC
just Marvel
combined.
And DC.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And this is why they're the kings of the hill, and this is why I think, going back to that idea, I think that all the independents, it is very much a us versus them kind of mentality.
Well, you know, it's you would think it's almost like the difference between not to bring politics into this, but you know, on this side of the border, you know, you have the Democrats and Republicans and a bunch of small other parties,
mm-hmm.
and that's just the way it's been. But you go north of the border, and you got about five or six different parties. All, you know, and about four of them are all about variants, you know, equal size, and then it gets smaller from there. And it just comes down to just how things are set up from the start. Marvel Timely Comics was fortunate in that from all those companies that started at the gate in the 30s and 40s, it was for some reason that it happened to either through smart marketing on their part or the way the wind was blowing, they were lucky in that they had Captain America and Submariner and these iconic characters that kind of helped them to raise above the fray. And DC was fortunate in that it had the big three that was able to help them, you know, pull ahead of the crowd. But then you ended up with about 20 years where it was just the two of them battling it out. And then the 80s comes along, and then all of a sudden all these smaller books are starting to show up on the radar, and they're enough to make a presence, but the presence isn't big enough to take out the 40% that one group is having and the 40% that the other is having, and all these other books are fighting over the other 20.
Yeah.
You know.
And a lot of it does come down to distribution. I think that if you study kind of the history of the distribution of comics, that you can see where a lot of this kind of plays in, and Marvel and DC have really kind of, you know, controlled it.
And it's not legally a monopoly.
Yeah.
No.
I don't see how it's not, but yeah, you're right. I mean, if it's not a monopoly, I don't know what it is.
It would be like an oligopoly, I would think.
Yeah. I get that, and, you know, for that, that's okay, I guess, legally, but, you know, some of the first independent books, you know, and Malibu being in there, and there was a couple others, there was some really good characters, some strong writing, some really quality books that only because they were from smaller presses
didn't get the they weren't getting the notice that
and that's
unfortunate, you know.
Well, one of the things that Malibu did, the Ultraverse did, and I can't remember exactly how the ad was worded. You probably could find it pretty easy, but we pushed that we were a universe of writers because Image had come out, and you know, there were their sort of thing was Image is everything, and it was all about the art, and you know, here we've got seven of the rock star artists. You know, who were doing their own things. They were doing their own creator-owned things. And so Malibu kind of came out with the, you know, idea, hey, look, you know, this is a big deal. Why don't we embrace the idea of storytelling? And so, you know, the founders at Marvel are, there's seven writers. You know, so it was sort of, you know, I always kind of thought of it, you know, Image had the seven artists, Malibu had, Ultraverse had the seven writers, and we got two completely different universes. One was all, you know, Image, and the other one had some content to it.
And just to follow up on the market share, I did find for September, the most recent one I could find. Mm-hmm. It's actually, believe it or not, it's not as it's slightly less heavy on Marvel and DC than it was August of last year. We got Marvel at 32.67, DC at 26.01. So that's roughly 58.5% of the market share now are those two, which is down a little bit from 2014. Image 11.8.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think you are seeing with the prevalence of like online publishing, where it's getting cheaper to publish.
Yes.
A comic book, especially if you do some of it online, and really just being able to communicate online, send stuff to the printer online. The production costs are coming down. So, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that it's all going to be even out in the very near future, but I think you are seeing some of the big two lose a little market share gradually.
I agree.
Smaller outfits.
Well, and I think exactly kind of what you're talking about. I think that because of the distribution methods, we are seeing that change. And again, I think we're going to be the ones that will reap the benefits as readers. We're going to be the ones that reap the benefits for that, because we're going to be able to see comic creators giving us their own. I mean, look, Walking Dead is a perfect example of that.
Right.
I was trying to see if I could find, you know, John Jackson Miller does. He does historical sales for comics, and I was trying to see if I could find the 1993. Oh, Comic Con's not up. But yeah, he does historically. It's called Comic Con, I think, for chronology. For some reason, I can't get that link to work. But anyway, I was going to try to go there. I still have, believe it or not, I've still got papers in a box somewhere. That have a lot of the numbers from there.
Now you were mentioning Walking Dead while we're doing this, while you're looking this up. And I know last show we talked briefly how Men in Black was one of the big titles that made the jump from page to screen. Were there other titles from Malibu that did the same?
So there are some that have been licensed, but I don't think have made it. Jerry Jones did a book called The Trouble with the Girls that I think had... I'm not sure how far it got. But Jerry Jones, The Trouble with Girls, there was Hollywood movement on that. Obviously, I did... I think I mentioned this to you last time. Cat and Mouse was optioned and went to... Pendentium Trilogy Entertainment. They're the guys who did Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I always have to stop my tongue from saying Robin Hood Men in Tights because I like that movie, but that's completely different people.
Yes.
And tight tights.
Tight tights. trying to think of what else. I can't think of any others that did. Nah, I can't think of any others. So here's I did find from October of 92. This is the August of 92 report.
The number one book for that month was Cable number one. Number two was X-Men 13. And then number three was Wildcats number two, which was an Image book. Number four was Youngblood Zero, Image book. Number five was Spawn 4, which was an Image book. Number six was Cyber Force 1, which was an Image book. So one, two, three, four, four of the top six books were Image books. So Marvel Comics, okay, you ready for this breakdown? Marvel Comics had 49.48% of the market. DC had 19.37%.
Wow.
Malibu had, yep, Malibu. And see, DC, people don't realize how bad DC was really hurting back then. And this is why they were really interested in Malibu. Malibu had 14.23%. Largely thanks to Image. Dark Horse had 5.05% of the market. Yeah, and so I think once you you remove, like, if we just assume that of that 14% that Malibu had, that and this is an assumption, of course, 10% of that is the Image books. Then you end up with about, 10% is an Image, 4.23 is Malibu. That's probably pretty close to what you're going to see. What is this? This is September. Yeah. So look, here is what's this month? September 92. So Spawn 5. Hold on, is that right? Spawn 4. So the very next month, okay, the very next month, Marvel Comics had 59% of the market. DC had 18.15, and Malibu had 10.2. That's what I'm saying. Marvel was such a powerhouse then. And this is why DC was looking at Malibu, because they were like, look, you guys are coming in. Now, I think some of this balanced out once the – because you got to remember, this is when they were doing all those really big multiple covers and everything. And once Image came around, I really believe that, again, I'm not giving you exact numbers, but I really believe the numbers were closer to more like a 45. Marvel had about a 45, and DC was, 35 or 40%, something like that. But DC was looking at us and saying, look, if we can get – your percent of the market share to add into DC, then that would actually bump us over Marvel, and I think that's what they were wanting to do.
Okay, so I guess after the whole Image thing and y'all were starting to get courted a little bit from DC, where do we go next in the history of Malibu?
Yeah, so what happens is DC begins to court Malibu. It was not a public thing, but it was I can't remember the guy's name. The president who retired a few years ago, DC Comics. He wrote. He used to write for Justice League. What the heck was his name?
Jeff Johns.
No. Older guy.
Giordano wasn't it? It wasn't Giordano.
No, it wasn't Giordano. Anyway, so the guy begins to just have regular meetings with the four founders of Malibu. The four founders of Malibu, obviously, are Chris Ulm, Tom Mason, Dave Olbrich, and Scott Rosenberg. And so he begins to have meetings with these guys. DC actually entered into what do they call when one company's getting ready to buy another one and they begin to examine their books? What's that called? They're examining
an audit.
It's not. Yeah, it's like an audit, but that's not the technical term for it. Due diligence.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Close enough. Yeah.
They were doing the due diligence, and they were in the office. We had accounting people auditing our books and looking at them, and this was a real thing. I mean, this was getting ready to happen. And so really what happens is Marvel catches wind of it. And, the industry was already beginning to crash, so everybody was having a hard time. Marvel sales were down, DC sales were down, Image sales were down, Malibu sales were down, all of us sales, everybody was having a hard time. We had the boom of the early 90s, and then we were experiencing, the crash. The market was flooded. The industry was just crashing. Marvel gets wind of this, and literally overnight, when the guy finds out, he flies to California, takes a meeting with Scott Rosenberg, and essentially says, whatever they're paying you, I'll double the offer. And yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so there you go. I became a Marvel employee. Because money talks, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So do you know who Ron Perlman is? Not the actor, but the billionaire dude.
Kind of, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, he owned, I think it was Revlon, right? And he was a Marvel owner back in then. Well, I didn't even realize this, but I was, 6 feet away from Ron Perlman, from billions of dollars. And here's how I knew it. I learned it after the fact, okay? So I was in there on a Saturday. I occasionally went to the office to do some stuff because we didn't have all the people running around. We didn't have the front office. So I wasn't getting phone calls all the time. It was one of those things that, occasionally I'd go in for a few hours on Saturday and get some work done unmolested by other people in the office. Well, I'm in there. We used to play basketball, a bunch of us, the editors and staff and stuff like that. We used to play basketball on Saturday mornings. And so I was up there, we played basketball, and I'd gone up to the office, and I'm in short pants and a t-shirt, kind of sweaty, probably, I had long hair back in the day, so I probably had my hair in a ponytail,
It was definitely business casual.
Yes, very much so. Well, and I'm sitting there, and here comes Scott Rosen. Now, if you know Scott, Scott's very, California to begin with is very anti-smoking, right? Well, Scott Rosenberg was like, there is no smoking in this building. If you're going to smoke, you're going to get out of this. Scott hated smoke, okay? I do too, but Scott just hated it. So next thing I know, here comes Scott walking up, and where I could sit at my desk, I had a shot all the way down one of the aisles, right? So here comes Scott walking up with this dude, all dressed impeccably, right, with a cigar, a lit cigar in his hand. And I'm like, this is interesting. Now, when Scott usually introduced me, it wasn't unusual that Scott would give tours, right, to people. He was always looking for money for the company. And usually when he would come around, he would say, oh, this is Roland. He's one of our editors. He edits it, blah, 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 and I'd say hi, and they would move along. This time, though, they walked by and didn't stop. Scott went, this is one of our editors, and just kept walking. And I'm like, okay, that was interesting. And I didn't find out until Monday when I come back to work that was the Revlon Ron Perlman and smoking his cigar.
I used to say, and this is one of the little people. Just kidding.
It's so funny, but that is exactly the way I felt. That is exactly the way I felt when they walked by.
So
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Please.
I was just gonna say I like Scott, so I know that he was courting money, and I get it. He was working, but it was just one of those things like, well, gee, Scott, that was really unusual for you.
So soup to nuts, from the time that you got wind that Marvel was interested to the point was boom, you're a Marvel employee. About what would be the time frame on that? Because it sounds like the DC courtship was something that happened over a good
several
period
months.
Of time. Yeah,
yeah. The DC thing was happened over a several months period, and I was aware of it of the DC thing. I just wasn't part of the meetings because that was for the founders. I'm going to say 2 weeks, if that.
Wow.
Yeah, it happened really, really fast.
Wow.
Yeah, really fast. And really, a lot of it was, it's a political move. They were trying to, trying to keep DC from getting it. But it happened really, really fast.
Now, see, the scuttlebutt that I had always been led to believe over the years was that Marvel was primarily interested in the colorists.
Yeah, and that's not true. So here's the deal, all right? I don't know. I mean, I have my suspicions. I don't know how much was paid. I have a pretty good idea what I think it was. And here's what I do know. On a regular basis, Image Comics would steal our colorist. We had a top-notch coloring program.
Yes, you
obviously.
Did.
Obviously. We employed about 120 colorists. And we worked, I don't remember how many computers we had, but we worked these guys around the clock. We had a 9-to-5 shift. We had that would be 5-to-11 shift or something like that, or 5-to-12. And then we had a graveyard shift. I mean, we worked those cute computers around the clock.
I, at one point, I wanted to be part of them.
So. Did you really?
Yes, I did.
Did you actually apply, or
I do believe I did.
Wow.
When Dagger went over, I was trying to get work with other companies, now that I think about it, Malibu was one of the first places that I went or sent to.
Well, your resume was probably off because we were hiring nonstop. I mean, like, again, what would happen is that we had so many terminals, right? And those terminals basically had to have bodies in them. And about every other week, there for a span of several months, Image was stealing one of our colors. And they would, and at first they would just call and say, "Hey, can I talk to somebody in the coloring department?" And our receptionist would just get them over, and they would say, "Hey, who's this?" Blah blah. And they would say, "Hey, I'm Image. What are they paying you? I will pay you this much money. Come down and work for us." And we got wind of that. And we finally told our receptionist, right, like, look, do not, the coloring, they don't get to talk to anybody. The colorist can only have personal calls, right? And so the Image would try to get, they would get sneaky, right? They knew some of the other people, so they would call and say, "Hey, let me talk to so-and-so." And then they would talk to this person, and they'd say, "Hey, man, put me over, patch me over to the coloring department." And so they were really sneaky in trying to steal our colors. And they were very effective for a time period. So here's what I can tell you. For the amount of money that Marvel spent to buy the company, they could have paid one-tenth of that and hired all 120 of our colorists. I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever. So here's the whole big picture of things, all right? Marvel had just gone public, right? They were a publicly traded company at this point in time. I forget who the president was, but if you know even a little bit about business, what's one of the things that a president has to do or CEO has to do to come and show that the business is healthy? They're going to say, look, we're growing the business, right? So what do? They buy Panini stickers, they buy Heroes World Distribution, they buy Malibu Comics. And then they can go to their shareholders and they can say, look, we're very healthy. We're purchasing this company. We purchased this company. This is good for us. We are healthy. It was a good thing. It was a political move, right? It was good for them, for their shareholders. Well, the other part of that is that, DC is going to buy this company, and suddenly all of that market share is going to go to DC, which is our number one competitor. No, we're not going to let that happen. It was a defensive move. We talked a little sports before you started recording, right? It was a defensive move. They're like, no, if DC gets these guys and adds to their market share, this could really have a negative effect on us. So, coloring department, that was just, it was an ingredient in the big picture. The other thing is, one of the things that some of the Marvel editors told us is that, one of the things that they heard from their end was that, Spider-Man's already been licensed. There's already been Spider-Man cartoons. There's already been Avengers, right? I mean, there's already all this stuff out there. There had never been a Prime movie before. There'd never been a Strangers cartoon, right? All of this stuff was virgin intellectual property that could be optioned and sold. And this is one of the things that Marvel was looking at. Look, this is a huge treasure trove of intellectual property that we can option off. Now, this is obviously before Marvel made their own movies, and they were optioning, Spider-Man to Sony and Fantastic Four to Fox and things like that, right? This is during those days. So that they were looking at Malibu as just more intellectual property to option off. So, again, the coloring was an ingredient, but yeah, if they were really buying Malibu for the coloring department only, that is one of the dumbest buys on the face of the earth. Because like I said, they could have come in and paid, one-tenth of what they paid for the entire company and hired the entire 120 colorists, right? I started to say kids. Sorry, I'm in teaching mode. But yeah, they could have hired all 120 of the staff away.
There's a part of me that is not taking this news very well, but on the other hand, it's good to hear the real reason behind it.
Yeah, what part of it is hard to hear?
The fact that it's because you heard
for so long.
Yeah, for so long.
You know, and what's weird is that's I That's one of the most persistent inaccuracies about the Marvel Malibu purchase that just continues to live on. And I've seen the founders talk about it. Tom Mason, of course, you know, I want to say founders, I mean all of the Malibu founders. I've seen him talk over and over and over again about, you know, look, this is not the case. Here it is. And just spell it out, you know, and but still it that idea persists, and I don't know why.
Well, I'm glad that you clarified that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a mighty expensive coloring department.
Yeah.
No, I kind of want
worth it, but it was good. Yeah.
I kind of want to backtrack a little bit.
Okay.
If I remember right, Malibu was one of the first to have their own video game company with Malibu
yes.
Interactive.
Malibu Interactive, that's right. This goes back to Malibu was looking for an influx of cash, money to keep the company moving, keep it going forward. Malibu Interactive came in. They were flush with cash because they had a couple of games that had done pretty well. I don't know what they were. I just remember the talk amongst the four founders. I gotta call them something different because there's the Ultraverse founders and the Malibu founders. And the four principals. How about that? The four principals that they were cash flush, and that's something that Malibu needed at the time. So yeah, Malibu Interactive came in as a partner. They brought a small staff and joined us in the offices, and you know that's how I think they're the ones that produced the Prime video game and something else. Maybe they did Dinosaurs for Hire. I can't remember. I didn't deal a lot with them. I saw their president because he became co-presidents with Scott essentially. And there were a couple of people that used to call. And here's one of these private. And yes, I do realize. So I'm not going to tell you where it comes from. But there was a joke that whenever Scott and his name was Bob. Whenever the two of them would like enter in the offices together, the joke was it's Dr. and Mr. Wallet.
I pulled up. There's actually a wiki page for what that's. So take that how you want of Malibu Interactive.
Oh yeah.
So there was an X-Mutants game.
Yes, there was.
And actually, I played this one game at a party earlier this year. The Time Tracks game.
Oh really?
Yeah. There was a Mech Warrior game. Dinosaurs for Hire.
Dinosaurs for Hire, yep.
There was a couple of movie games. What, Cliffhanger? Three Ninjas Kick Back? Wow.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize this. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, CinemaWare founder, Bob Jacob. And he's the Bob I told you that it was Dr. and Mr. Wallet, right? Bob and Scott. 1994. So, I don't remember exactly. The Malibu Interactive part, the game part of it, I don't think was purchased by Marvel when they did it. I think that was something completely separate.
I thought they did buy it.
Well, maybe they did. I don't know.
According to this article, let me see. Malibu Entertainment was acquired by Marvel Entertainment Group. In 2012, Malibu Interactive was rebranded to become a full-service digital agency.
Oh, huh. Interesting. Yeah.
So, we've covered up to Marvel's now bought Malibu, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, things were good, right?
Yeah. Despite the fact that I was surprised to suddenly find Spider-Man on my paycheck instead of Batman. We were very excited about it. Part of it was this, okay? We were just cocky enough to think that what we were doing was really good stuff. We would look at what we were doing and say, you know, we've got the jam, and we just need more, we need more muscle. We need more people to listen to us. We need the muscle that a Marvel could bring. And so we were really excited. We were excited about the fact that Marvel was going to be able to bring us a muscle that we didn't have and let us still continue to do what we do. So yeah, there was a lot of excitement in it. Now, I will say this. The Ultraverse founders, they weren't exactly 100% completely excited about it. Steve Gerber called me the day he heard about it and just said, it's all over. It's all over. It's done. It was fun, but we're done. Because, you know, Steve Gerber, of course, is the guy who created Howard the Duck. And he had a long-running feud with Marvel. Steve did Sludge for us. And I was very fortunate enough to be his editor. But, yeah, that was the conversation.
I remember Sludge.
That was the conversation I had with Steve. Now he continued to work, obviously, but yeah, he was like, nope, it's done. We're finished. We're through. So we were very, very excited. The first thing in a matter of about a month and a half, 6 weeks or so, maybe 2 months, something like that. The thing that we began to notice as editors is suddenly my books were not being colored on time because the Marvel books were taking priority.
Oh.
And the way they justified that was it was justified by sales. Now, what would happen in the coloring department did not like working with the Marvel editors because they were perpetually late. They would get their books delivered to Malibu and they would say, I need this in 2 days. I would deliver, on the other hand, I would book and I would say, I need this in 3 weeks. You know, because we had a production schedule. This is the kind of thing. I mean, like I said, we were on top of this thing. Tom Mason ran our he was our production Nazi. I mean, we had Monday morning production meetings every single Monday. First thing we did to start off our week, he produced a list, and we went over it. And he basically said, you know, Roland, here's what's due from you. Hank, here's what's due from you. And we knew. And if we didn't do it, man, you did not want to unleash the wrath of Tom. They didn't like dealing with the Marvel editors at all. That's just a blanket statement, because, you know, there were a whole bunch of them, and I'm sure there were some of them that were very, very nice, very easy to work with. But on the whole, our coloring department didn't like to work with them because they were so, you know, here it is, it's late, I need you to do this in 3 days. And then they wanted them to do, you know, top-notch, you know, work when they're like, look, you're giving us very little time to do this in, and to do the kind of work that you want us to do, we need a little bit more time. So that was kind of the first thing we began to see production-wise. Well, we just rolled with it. You know, we're like, okay, well, it makes sense. X-Men outsells us, so they get the coloring, and I'll schedule with, you know, something else, schedule down the line. When we flew out and met with the Marvel editors. I don't know if y'all heard this or not, but we flew out and met with them. So we flew to New York and met with the Marvel staff, and you could tell they were like, yeah, we don't really want you here. We didn't have anything to do with the purchase. And, of course, we didn't either. You know, we're just editors. But they're like, yeah, we don't really want you here. They didn't say this. This was never said, okay? They were always cordial. I tell you who one of my favorite ones immediately was, of course, is Mark Gruenwald. He and I, we began to talk not specific politics, but broader politics. And I recommended, matter of fact, I don't have it here. There's a book called The Nine Nations of North America. And we talked about basically the cultural, because obviously I'm from Mississippi, right?
Right.
Gruenwald's, he's a native New Yorker, and we're nothing alike. And so we were just very interested in a lot of those kinds of things and talking about why, you know, well, you do this and I do this. And let's talk about some of these things. You know, I love sweet tea. And, you know, the only sweet tea that you can get north of the Mason-Dixon line is a jar of tea and a packet of sugar. And that ain't the same.
You know, it's not.
It's just not. And so we were discussing about this. You know, I was telling him about this book. He said, yeah, you know, I'd be interested in that. So I sent him the book to read. And I got it back about a week or 2 weeks or something like that, just before he died. So one of the things that before we made the trip, one of the things that we were told is that they were curious to see how we would handle some of their properties, all right? Because Marvel editors, this was all new to them too, right? Marvel never acquired, to my knowledge, Marvel never acquired a company like this, Lock, Stock, and Barrel. And keep in mind, this is in the days before Thor was a popular character. So they had kind of come up with a list of some of their C-tier characters that could possibly be done by Malibu Comics. And, of course, great. On that list were characters like Submariner, Thor, Adam Warlock, the Black Knight,
somebody else. I forget. You know, and so these were all, this was like, oh, wow, yeah, we would love for Malibu to do a Thor book. How cool would that be for us to be able to do Thor in the way we, you know, we were handling it? I think ultimately they chickened out and they were like, yeah, no, we don't think, we don't want this to happen. But we got Loki. So we got Loki and a crossover. And because of, you know, because of Loki and the crossover, we got the Black Knight. If you'll remember, the Black Knight joined the Ultra Force, and became the leader of the team for a period of time. We did get Adam Warlock for a while, and Lynn Kaminsky had come up with this very cool idea in which Adam Warlock was going, Rune was going to be the historical Adam Warlock kind of thing in the past. And so it was going to be a very, very, very cool story. We also got Juggernaut. I edited the Exiles, so we got Juggernaut. So, you know, we didn't quite get to do a Thor and a Submariner book and things like that. But we did get the crossovers. Now, for us, that was kind of a disappointment. We were kind of like, well, you know, yeah, it was kind of exciting to think that we could do the Ultraverse version of Thor, you know. Crossovers were like, yeah, okay, we'll still get some Marvel, you know, some of the Marvel readers, they might actually know who Ultraverse is then, and some of this market share will help grow us. Yeah, it didn't exactly end up the way we anticipated it to end up.
So what... How long was Malibu under Marvel, I guess, rule or under Marvel thumb before the decline?
About a year before the when you say the, you know, define decline.
I guess when pretty much the big quake occurs and okay. Everything's shaken up and Malibu
so
becomes no more.
Yeah. So what happens
Black
is,
September, basically.
Okay, now that's kind of funny that you say that, because Black September, you're talking about the comics, right?
Yeah.
Black September, obviously was in September. By the time we got to Black September, we had had, or it was about that time, some of the principals left. I've mentioned to you Dave Ulbrich, Tom Mason, Chris Allman, Scott Rosenberg. Dave was let go. After several months, they actually just said, Dave, your job is duplicate and we don't need you anymore. That was a big shock to the company, because Dave, you know, for us, Dave was, he was one of the four. You know, I mean, the company was started by these four guys. He was one of the four. I think when Dave was let go, everybody began to realize, okay, wait a minute. There's something, you know, something not right. Dave's been in comics a long time. Surely you could have found something for him to do, even if it's not retained the title of publisher. And so that sent ripples. Well, as you know, as I mentioned, the coloring problems and things like that, the scheduling problems as far as the coloring goes. And there were other smaller things. Tom Mason and Chris Alton left the company. And so I'm sitting there thinking, you know, Tom Mason and Chris Alton were the two guys that I did most of my freelance work with before even moving out there. And now Dave Ulbrich is gone, Tom Mason is gone, and Chris Alton is gone. Three of the four, you know, 75% of the four founders, the guys who I looked at as this is Malibu, were gone. Scott Rosenberg then sort of took on and Scott Rosenberg was a busy, busy dude. I mean, he was doing, you know, he was having to do everything, and he was caught with Marvel too. But now, one of the things that began to happen is I began to learn that Chris, to a great extent, Tom probably to a smaller extent, but Chris was a big filter for the suits, if you will. There would be ideas coming out. We need to do this. Well, Chris would be able to stop them, saying, no, we're not doing that. That's stupid, right? And once Chris was gone, that didn't exist anymore. That filter wasn't there. It probably won't surprise you to learn that a lot of these big event things are marketing driven. Okay, the Black September thing was obviously it was market. We needed an event, and that's what happens. Marketing comes to you, and they say we need an event. Well, you know, sales are beginning to decline by this time here. We need an event, something to happen. And so, you know, what we usually do, or what we would do, is we'd go back to the writers. Hey guys, you know, here they're telling us we got to have some big crossover thing. What do you want to do? And we would just kind of go from there. I don't remember, to be honest with you, I don't remember the specifics of who came up with the Black September idea.
But part of what happened is we were having problems licensing some of the characters. One of the primary examples is Mantra. I don't know how much you remember about Mantra, but Mantra was a male warrior trapped in a female body. Mm-hmm. She was obviously, she was bodacious to look at in the comics, but mm-hmm. the personality was a male personality because he mind hopped through time, right? And what would happen is they would go to license Mantra. And you can remember this was 90, you know, early 90s. It may not be an issue today. I don't know. I think there might still be some big toy companies who might hesitate at this. But they would say, wait a minute, whoa. Mantra is a dude in a woman's body? Yeah, no, we don't want to make a toy of that. No one would touch it. And so there were issues. And we, you know, we had other issues as well. And of course, you know, this was in the day of new number ones. Let's say we did new number one, blah, blah, blah. So we just came up with the idea that here's what are some of the things. Let's fix some of the things that we can see that we think are wrong with our, the Ultraverse now. Now, did everything come out right? No, probably not. Obviously, hindsight is 20/20. But what we actually did is we told Mike Barr, for instance, with Mantra, we said, hey, Mike, here's the deal. Mantra has to be a girl. She can't be a dude trapped in a. She can't be a dude trapped in a man's body. Go fix it. So we didn't, you know, as the Mantra editor, I didn't dictate to Mike to say Mantra is going to be Lauren. This is who the new Mantra is. No, all I said is like, Mike, they tell me, right? The suits now tell me that Mantra has to be a female. Let's make it happen. And so it was all tossed back. And so all of the stuff was Mike's idea, you know, as the creator of Mantra. It was all his idea. And one of the things that kind of made Mike mad, and it made me mad too, when we did Black September, I can't remember if it was number zero or number one, we had the book ready to go. And when I say ready to go, like I was sending it out to the press in 2 days. I had all of the film completely run. In those days, they would color it. We'd actually run film. And I had all of the film sitting on my desk, okay? It was ready to go to press. I won't mention a name, but a CEO comes by and starts flipping through it and says, is this the issue? I'm like, yeah. Where's her costume? She wasn't in costume because we were trying to make the change from old Mantra to new Mantra, right? And so essentially the decision came down. It's like, okay, we need a bikini scene. Add 3 pages of Lauren in a bikini. So I was like, but this book is ready to go to press. I'm getting ready to send it out in 2 days. Oh, it needs, I will, you know, we'll make sure it gets okay because, you know, I mean, to add 3 pages means that I got to lose 3 editorial pages somewhere, which could be, you know, sold ads or in-house ads. And so it got approved and I had to add 3 pages of Lauren in a bikini. So if you ever go back and look at Mantra, it's probably Mantra number one, probably not number zero. If you ever go back and look, it's 3 pages longer than the normal comic, and that's because we added the 3-page bikini scene, and that makes absolutely no sense where it's stuck in.
A printing standpoint, that's an expensive number to put in because you normally have, let's see, it's usually at least 4-page spreads
mm-hmm.
to insert into a book.
Yep. It was a mess.
Ouch.
It was a mess. Yeah. So Black September was something that was generated in an effort to increase sales, make some changes to some of the books that not all of the books needed it. I mean, if you're an Ultraverse reader, you can read it and say, well, really nothing changed here, you know, with Prime. I mean, what happened really? You know, Prime really didn't need to be, you know, he really didn't need any tweaking. He was doing pretty good on his own. Nightman, we were having trouble selling Nightman, you know, so that we made the changes with Nightman. And Steve Englehart's the one who created, you know, came up with those ideas. We actually didn't get to do everything Steve wanted to do, but we did a lot of it. So, you know, again, part of it is you have to keep in mind, a lot of people blamed Marvel for Black September. And it really wasn't, I mean, we were Marvel, so I guess you could say, yes, it was Marvel, but really it was all about the sales. You know, sales were declining. We would have had to do some, had Marvel not come around, we probably would have had a Black September months earlier, if that makes sense to you. But because Marvel came around and we had suddenly we had a deep pockets, we were able to go for many more months than we would have been without the financial stability of a Marvel. And of course we know that really wasn't the case because Marvel declared bankruptcy
not long after that. But at the time, you know, we didn't think Marvel go bankrupt. No, really, no. Their stock was performing fantastic.
Too big to fail.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Their stock had split twice. It was just one of those things that we were just trying to make sure that there was an Ultraverse in a month, in 2 months, and next year.
Okay.
So.
Now, I know it's been talked about by Quesada and by Englehart briefly on why we're not seeing Malibu characters now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know any of the details? And is this something you could talk about?
There are some things I can, some things I can't. So what did Englehart say? I'm familiar with what Quesada said, but I'm not sure what Englehart said.
According to what I found when doing some of the research, in May of 2012, Englehart suggested in a podcast interview that the reason Marvel will not presently publish the Ultraverse characters is because 5% of the profits from those books would have to go to Malibu creators that are still alive.
Okay.
Tom Brevoort later denied that the 5% was what was holding Marvel back, but was unable to give a real explanation due to a non-disclosure agreement.
Okay. So here's the deal. 5% is not... Marvel already does this to a lot of their creators anyway, right? 5% is almost nothing. And I heard somebody once before say, well, Marvel couldn't figure out how to do the accounting. All right. Here's the deal. Malibu had an accounting staff of 3, or maybe 4, okay? They could figure it out, right? Are you trying to tell me that Marvel's accounting staff of 4, I'm sorry, Malibu's accounting staff of 4 can figure out how to do royalties where Marvel's huge accounting department can't? No. That's bunk. You know what? Again, Marvel and DC both have this thing where they do pay creators now royalties, these incentives for creating, I forget exactly what they're called. Many of the creators have that, and I'm sure most of our founders have it for Marvel and the Marvel and DC books. That is not the thing that's keeping them. So here's the thing that I can tell you that is not going to be politically correct, and it certainly won't win me very many friends. But here's the deal. They just don't want. I can't talk to you about some of the things about the contract, but it is not the contract. It is not the contract with the founders that is stopping Marvel from doing it. They don't want to deal with the personalities. This is the problem. Is that obviously Steve Gerber was one of the bigger ones, right? And Steve Gerber already had a track record of arguing and fighting with Marvel. Some of those guys have some egos, and they don't. So here's the thing I'd ask you. Of those founders, how many of them are getting work from Marvel and DC today? Okay?
Okay.
They don't want to work with them. They're hard to, some of them are hard to get along with. You guys already know how much I love Steve Englehart, okay?
Right.
He is one of my favorite people. I love working with Steve Englehart, but he put me in my place very quickly. I said something to him once before about making some changes to something, and he said something to me like, I've made more books a hit than you've ever even edited. You know, how are you telling me what to do in a comic? So part of it was, here was a seasoned pro, right? And I'm a comic rookie coming in. You know, I've been working in the industry, 4 years at this point in time? Very much a rookie. 92 by the time 93. 4 years. You know, I've been working in the industry for 4 years. Now, I'm a lifelong comic reader, obviously. But I was a rookie, and Steve had been around for a long time. And here I am, I'm telling him, let's make these changes, let's make these changes. He didn't want to do it because he was the pro, and he was going to tell me how it was done. And again, I like Steve Englehart quite a bit. But he was, he could sometimes be hard to work with because I did not have the experience that he brought. So this is why I'm saying I'm sure I'm not winning very many friends, but I just think Marvel does not want to deal with these guys. They just don't want to deal with them.
And as as bad as it's going to sound, they don't have to.
No, they don't. But that's not. But so here's the thing with that, with this problem though. Marvel could start the Ultraverse and not include the Founders at all. However, if they did that, what would happen?
It hit the fan.
It's bad press. No one, I mean, they don't want to say, oh, look, Marvel's doing the Ultraverse, but they didn't ask any of the Founders to participate, right? And so, yeah, it hit the fan, and they don't want this bad PR. They would just, yeah. Hey, look, just let it sit. Let's just bury it. This way we don't have to deal with it. But, yeah, you know, that's the thing I always bring up. Look at the Founders. How many of them are getting work from Marvel or even DC? How many of them are getting work from Marvel or DC today? It has nothing to do with the contracts. And I know people don't want to hear that, you know, and people get mad at me for saying it. And keep in mind, this is only my opinion, right? Okay. So, but I look at what's going on. I look at what these, you know, what they're doing. And you tell me, you know, why is Stephen Gart not writing a Batman book? Why is Mike Barr not doing, you know, something at Marvel? I'm just saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what led to the final nail being driven into the Malibu coffin?
Well, it was in the same way that that corporate politics brought about the purchase of Marvel, corporate politics brought about the demise. As Marvel suffered corporately, as their stock, you know, we already said their stock went up, split twice, they crashed hard. They replaced their president. And, of course, what's the first thing a new president comes in and does?
Changes.
Starts changing, right? Mm-hmm. Where the other guy was saying, look, I'm growing the company. Look, I've added this. The new president comes in and he says, look, I'm trimming the fat. And so what he does is he just begins to cut the fat, right? Look, oh, well, we don't need this. Oh, we don't need this. We don't need this. Malibu was just part of the fat that he had to trim. Again, people have asked me before, you know, am I mad or upset? I mean, there's the thing about, well, A, no one likes to lose a job, right? B, I was in comics, and so it was lots and lots of fun. But I don't take it personal. I don't believe they said, oh, that Roland man, he's got to go, you know? No, I was employee number 45321, and you know, I had a salary, and it had to get cut. You know, that's part of the fact that just had to be trimmed. I will tell you this, though. We kind of knew it was coming. Obviously, you know, we knew the state of the industry, we knew the state of sales and that kind of thing. Scott Rosenberg was, and I can't remember the exact the days of the week, but I do remember that it happened on January the 4th. So Scott was called in to go to New York. He frequently went to New York because, you know, he was now CEO. He frequently went to New York for the business stuff. Well, on the 2nd, he was called in, January the 2nd, they called him and said, Scott, you need to come to New York tomorrow, right? And he said, okay, you know, well, Scott called me and Hank is the other Ultraverse editor. It was pretty much just early on, it was, you know, Dan Danko did a lot of the stuff, Ohm did a lot of it. Well, once I got there, Dan kind of shifted over to doing special projects and cards, and it was kind of me and Hank did about, he did about 50%, I did about 50% of the books. And so Scott called me and Hank, and he said, look, I'm going to New York, and I'll be out of pocket. Obviously, you can't, you know, it's a 5-hour flight, no cell phones back then. And so I'm going to be out of pocket. I'll call you when I know what's going on. Well, Scott's in the air flying. We start getting phone calls, right? This is on January the 3rd. We start getting phone calls. Hey, man, have you heard so-and-so got fired at Marvel? No, I didn't hear about that, right? Oh, that's too bad. I wonder why, you know? Oh, had you heard so-and-so got fired at Marvel? No, really? I heard so-and-so was fired. Oh, and we started getting these calls from freelancers, right? Because the grapevine is, comic book industry is a small industry. People talk. And so we started getting these calls, all these editors at Marvel losing their job. Like, oh my goodness, really? And so we realized that it was a bloodletting over there. And so we began, the rest of our day was shot, of course. And so, you know, several of us got together. It was like me, Hank, Jim Chadwick, who is now a DC editor. We all kind of got together and we said, you know, is it coming? Yeah, it's coming. We're next. You know, they put Scott in the air so that he would know all this is going on, right? If Scott had been in pocket, he would know what's happening. So they put Scott in the air, flew him to New York, that night, me and several of them, Jim Chadwick and several of them, we went ahead and packed up our offices. I took up all of the things that I said, okay, if there's ever any contention, this is mine. I'm taking it home. I just went ahead and packed it up. I brought my wife up that night. I had keys to get in the building. Obviously, brought my wife up that night and went ahead and made a whole carload. Right, and took all the stuff home. I showed up the next morning at about 7:30. I didn't usually get in until 8:30 or so, but I showed up that morning at 7:30. Wanted to be one of the first in. 30 minutes after I showed up, armed guards appeared at the door. And at 9 o'clock on the nose, they began calling. Hank Canales, please report to the Scott Rosenberg's office. Well, we had talked to Scott that night. And he confirmed that, yes, Marvel had fired a whole bunch of people. And we just asked him, Scott, are we next? And he says, I don't know. He goes, I'm going to meet with them in the morning. While Scott was meeting with them in New York, they were firing everybody. They sent their hatchet man out, obviously, to California and fired 200 people there at Malibu.
Wow.
Hank was the first one called, and I was the second one. I knew what it was when, because he was called, spent about 10 minutes there, came, my office was right beside his, and when I saw him walking back, he just gave me the thumbs down sign, and I was called right after him, and same thing happened to me, so, and they just proceeded to lay waste.
Wow.
That was a very sad day.
To say the least.
Yeah.
Man.
I still remember that. There was a lot of crying going on that day, you know. I mean, just because a lot of people, you know, we talked sports earlier. I'm very much a team player. You put me on your team, I'm a team player. You know, I'm going to do everything. I work at Full Sail now, and I am very much a Full Sail team player. Now, are you going to – I won't do it now because you're recording. You going to ask me if I think Full Sail is perfect? No, of course not. I've got some problems. You know, everybody has problems with where they work. But I'm going to talk about those things to my boss, to my coworkers, say, how can we fix this? How can we make this? I'm a Full Sail instructor. I this is what I do. I want you to come to Full Sail, and I want you to get a great education. I want to be able to teach you how to write comic books because that's what I enjoy doing. I'm a team player. And so a lot of people were that way at Malibu. I mean, it was very much a when I say family, obviously we weren't family, but it was very much a family environment. Heck, my kid, my oldest daughter was born when I was out there. She was about 3 months old, and her daycare just closed down because a kid caught meningitis, and they ruled it unsafe. Well, we didn't have any place to go, and if any of you got kids, you know it's sometimes hard to find daycare. So I just talked to Scott and said, Scott, can I bring my daughter in here? And I said, she doesn't move. I just put her on the floor on a blanket and do my work. And, you know, he said, well, what happens if you have to have meetings? I said, well, can I get one of the colorists to watch over? And we had some senior colorists who had their own desk. And so, you know, I would just ask some of the girls, hey, can I put my daughter here on the floor and you watch over while I'm at the meeting? Yeah. So they took care of my kid while I was in, you know, because my wife was working as well. And, so yeah, it was a pretty emotional day.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, especially considering how small Malibu was at the start.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a small, I don't want to say workforce, but you have a small group. You tend to get to know each other.
Yeah,
you tend to hang out with each other, and you.
Yep.
So yes, when that rug gets pulled out from underneath you, yes, it's definitely to say it's a blow is kind of selling it short.
Yeah,
I would think.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, several of our obviously you're not supposed to have inner office relationships, but those things happen. You work with people. Well, Hank, after all this, you know, he ended up marrying one of the colorists. Emily was one of our coloring captains. Mark Panicia had married one of our colorists. I think they've since gotten divorced, but they had married. We had another. There was another relationship like that in the office. I can't. He wasn't an editor. I can't remember what his title was. But yeah. So you know, I flew back to California to be one of Hank's groomsmen. You know. So yeah, there was. It was a lot of that.
Yeah.
Well, the books that were set to be published at the time that the culling happened, mm-hmm. did those books get dropped at that point, or did they?
No, Marvel kept a skeleton staff. What's weird is this was one of the things that I actually this was my bone of contention with them, is that at that point in time, once Dan Danko had left. Obviously, Scott. When Tom Mason and Chris Allen, those were the two of the principals. Dan Danko was the senior editor. When Dan Danko left, I became the senior most editor there. When this happened, they told me that the people who fired me said, "Yeah, they're going to keep a skeleton staff here, just a couple of people to get the books. We're not going to start anything new, but just the ones that have been in production, we're going to finish those." I said, "Oh, well, that'll be me since I'm the senior editor, right?" They say, "No, Marvel has chosen who they want to be." To do this, and so Marvel chose the editor that they wanted to finish out all of them. So here's the deal, though: the editor that they chose had never done anything at all with the Ultraverse at all. Obviously they had, you know, they knew they worked in the company. You know what's going on. But they did not edit a single Ultraverse book at all prior to that. And so they finished out, I want to say about 7 months of it happened after that. I will fess up to you, there are still a handful of Malibu books, Ultraverse books that I don't own because they came out after the time that I left, and I just don't have them. It's one of those things that, I wasn't going to go back up to the office and ask for them, you know what I mean? It's like, hey, I worked on these books, are you going to give them to me? And I certainly wasn't going to go spend any money on them, you know. there's still a handful of just the last few months of books that I don't have. So
man,
I keep telling myself I'm going to put together a list and scour the cheap boxes for them because I'm sure they're there.
Yeah. So
okay, go ahead.
I was going to ask, do you have any contact with people at Marvel now?
At Marvel?
Yes.
Very little. Obviously, there's some folks that I still know some of the people who are there. So my contact with them is purely kind of, you know, we're friends on Facebook, and I comment on some of their posts and things like that. Oddly enough, I have more contact with people at DC today than I do Marvel. And I don't know how closely y'all follow this, but if you look at the editorial staff at DC today, it's very eerily similar to the Marvel staff in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's the same people. It's the same people. So I actually have more contact with the current DC editorial crew than I do Marvel.
Okay, here's a hypothetical situation for you.
Okay.
All right, say one of your contacts over at Marvel mm-hmm. calls you up and says, look, we want to bring back one title from Ultraverse. You will be editing. This will be your baby. You choose mm-hmm. which one do you bring back.
Any of them or only the ones that I edited?
I'd say let's go either one.
Okay. So normally that's a pretty easy answer for me to give. I absolutely loved Sludge because I think Steve Gerber was just a brilliant writer. I think Steve Gerber was probably the smartest of the writers that I worked with. I don't know that, God rest his soul, because he's gone from us now. I don't know that any of the founders would argue with that. I think Steve was probably just one of the most brilliant writers that I got to work with. So Sludge would be, but I don't know that I would want Sludge without Gerber. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So
yes, makes total sense.
So without that, do the founders come back with them?
Sure. Let's say founders come back with them. To let bygones be bygones, and you'll hit the reset button, shall we say.
Well, and then I say that it has to be Prime.
Okay.
Because I think Prime has the out of all of the Ultraverse books, I think Prime had a fantastic mood and spirit mm-hmm. about it. I think it was fun. I think it had a young protagonist. Obviously, Kevin was a young boy, and You know, we haven't broached the subject at all, I don't think, in part of our conversations, but, you know, a big part of why I think the reason comics are having such a hard time today is because we no longer sell to a young audience.
That's a good point. They're not.
You know, I think distribution, I think, has a lot to do with it, too, because, you know, when we were young and buying comics, we could buy them off the spinner rack. We could get, and those were everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Those don't exist today. I mean, if you're a kid and you're going to go buy a comic book, you have to go to a comic shop. You have to go
or
to a comic
Barnes
store.
And Noble.
Or Barnes and Noble, yeah. And those are graphic novels. Those aren't comic books. Like, you know, when we were, again, I used to mow yards. That's how I made my money. I could take a dollar and I could go buy three comics and a candy bar, mm-hmm. you know? And before they went up to 35 cents, I could get three comics, candy bar, and a Coke, you know? So it was the kind of thing that they weren't expensive. I think comics are expensive today as well, but I just don't think we're not building a new generation of comic book readers. So this is one of the things that I like about Prime. I think Prime is geared for a younger reader, but you and I can enjoy it too.
Yeah, I did like the fact that that you have this like almost 8 foot tall, make Superman look anemic superhero. That's really just—he's like an eighth grader.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, you know, just he deprimes, and it's kind of like, oh, look, there's Kevin. Nobody's going to assume Kevin is this muscle-bound superhero flying through
right.
the air.
Yeah,
and plus you get to tell stories from an eighth grader's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's that opportunity. I would have to, if I were getting that call, that's who I would choose as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've always liked the idea. I get that we have mature comics. I don't like that the overwhelming majority of our comics today, I wouldn't let my kids read, just because, you know, they're made for a mature audience. I like the Bugs Bunny model, okay? For me, I think the Bugs Bunny model of storytelling is what at least Marvel and DC and a good many other comic companies. Listen, Bugs Bunny is funny. I don't know how often when's the last time you watched Bugs Bunny. I know you enjoyed it as a kid, okay?
A couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I was gonna say, but if you've watched Bugs Bunny recently, you know there's a lot of adult humor in Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
But it's told in such a way that your kids can watch it and it is purely safe and they can have fun and you and I can watch it and we can go, ah, I see what you did there. That's funny.
The jokes fly right over their heads and hit you and me right in the face.
That's right.
Yep.
Yep. And to me, I think a lot of the Marvels, particularly Marvels, because again, I'm a mighty Marvel geek. The Marvels in the 70s were that way. You know, the Englehart, the Roy Thomas, the Steve Gerber, these guys, Mark Wolfman, that's the kind of stories they wrote using the Bugs Bunny model. You know, they were writing, yes, to a younger audience, but as you got older, you can go, ah, see what's going on there. I know what's happening, right?
Yeah. So
yeah, Prime would be my choice.
I like that choice.
So
obviously,
anything that we missed that could be brought up, or do we pretty much cover everything with the?
We covered a lot. Yeah. Are there any other secret questions that you can think of that you've just been dying to ask that you want to ask?
What was behind the fourth door on the right if you knocked three times, spun around, and spit over your left shoulder?
Oh, that's pretty easy. That was Scott Rosenberg's secret room.
Okay.
So I will tell you this. Here's one of the cool things that I wonder what happened to. We had a huge art room. And when I say art room, I mean it was an archival system for art. Mm. It was temperature controlled. It had a key card lock on it. Only the editors and the coloring department. Can't remember I don't think all the captains had it, but I think just the coloring department boss, supervisor had. There weren't very many keys to get into that room because obviously it was original art. We would get our original art, right? And they would make all of our copies, do our scanning, and then original art would go into this art room. When you went into this art room, you were surrounded by all of the art of the company. It was very, very cool to be in it. You could catch the editors sometimes if you were going in there. You know, I would go in there sometimes and I'd catch Hank in there just looking through pages. right? What are you doing, Hank? Oh, man. Gabriel, he would look at Gabriel Gecko, did Prototype. You know, actually, Gabriel Hardman, you probably know his name. You just look into the artwork, and I would do the same thing, of course. I would go in there, and I'd say, ooh, Hank got the, you know, the newest issue of Solution in here. I'm going to flip through the pages, you know. So, yeah, that was very cool. And I wish I had more photos, pictures, and maybe even some video of the offices and stuff.
Are there I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I have a couple of pictures from the old office, from pre-Marvel purchase. I was in two offices when Malibu was in two different locations when I was out there. The first one was in Westlake Village, and then we moved to Calabasas, which is then where the we moved to Calabasas after the Malibu Interactive, and then we were there when Marvel purchased us. So it was a big place.
Are there any story arcs or plot threads that you just you think back, you go, I really wish we had tied that one up?
There are actually two things that I wish had happened. Okay, we did a mini, you know, after Black September Prototype was canceled because it was one of the ones that we were struggling with sales. We did a Prototype miniseries that was actually going to be, you know, we had originally scheduled to be like, you know, issues 18, 19, 20, 21, whatever. But we decided, you know, after it was all happened, we'll re-release it as a miniseries. We get a new number one, right, and number two. And it was called Prototype Turf Wars. It was penciled by Gabriel Hardman, inked by Stephen Baskerville. All that stuff is beautiful. It never saw print. Mm. It never saw print. Here's the other thing. Steve Gerber co-wrote, I think he did more editing than he did co-writing, a Sludge one-shot. You know, we did the Sludge Red Xmas with Mike Plug, which I think was fantastic. But Mitch Bird, who I worked with on Cat and Mouse, and I don't know how familiar you are with Mitch's work. Mitch is made to draw monster stuff. Okay, he's just he's just really, really, really gorgeous stuff. He did a lot of Green Lantern, Guy Gardner Green Lantern, and you look at it and it's like, I like Mitch's stuff, but Mitch doesn't like superheroes, and I think you can kind of see that reflected in the art. But his Sludge stuff that he did was fantastic. It was beautiful. It was some of them. To me, it was on par with Mike Klug's Sludge. It was gorgeous stuff. Some of the best looking Sludge stuff that no one will ever see.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, I wish, I can't remember what that one was called. Swamp of Souls, maybe. I wish that those two things had been published. That is, I don't know that I really wish we, you know, can go back and redo stories. You can always kind of redo, you know, kind of rehash things like that. But out of all of my wishes, I wish those two things had been published, because I think that would be one of the things that all three of you would say, oh, yeah, man, that was great. I love that, you know.
Well, okay, I'm going to ask you to pull out your crystal ball.
Okay.
Do you think Marvel will ever do, I don't know, trade paperback collections of any of the, any of the Ultraverse stuff?
You know, I don't know. To me, that's one of the things that's kind of the no-brainer there. Because it would seem like, yeah, well, the stuff already exists and all we have to do. The problem comes in where I don't know how much of the digital files they still have. Obviously, it would take a lot of work. If they don't have the digital files, it would take a lot of work to scan and recolor. And I don't know that they view any of that material as worth that effort. If, however, they still have the digital files, and there's no reason they shouldn't have, right? Because we kept really immaculate files and filing systems and everything on disk and everything.
What kind of disk?
Well, PsyQuest disk.
Oh God!
No. So there may be some correct conversions that they would have to do, but that's minimal in the whole scheme of things. If that exists for them, to me, that's a no-brainer for them to do. Do it both digitally and you know, make it available as a trade paper. I don't see why they wouldn't do that. I don't know that they care, though. And the other thing is, I don't know that part of it is, you know, part of what they have to do is they have to look at it in the broad scheme of things. If they do all of this work to this book, is it going to generate enough revenue for them to make it worth their while?
Mm.
I don't have the answer to that. Obviously, I would love to see it happen, obviously, but I think that that's kind of the this is what their discussion is. Is it worth our time doing?
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be a percentage of the population that would like to see it, that would love to see it, that would pay to get it.
Yeah.
But question is, I mean, would it be enough? And
right.
While as fans, we don't like the decision, but when you have to look at it from the perspective they have to look at it,
yeah,
it's kind of hard to argue it.
It is. Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, like you said, you know, there's the fan perspective, but then there's the business perspective, and you gotta walk that line.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I like about trades and collections and stuff like that is they can really kind of, they have perpetual shelf life, you know?
They do. They do.
Where an individual comic has a very limited shelf life. You can do, you know, I would love to see them do, you know, a Prime Omnibus. Collect all the Prime issues and just say, look, here's the Prime. I mean, you could put that on your, comic shops could put that on the shelf to stay there for a long time, you know?
I'd buy it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think so. I mean, I think a lot of folks would.
Well, I almost hate to bring this to a close, but thank you for coming on.
And, oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Allowing us to get into even more depth with the history of Malibu.
And for clearing up some Malibu myths.
Yeah.
Malibu,
yeah,
marble myths. Triple M. There you go.
That coloring thing is it just always comes up. But, you know, now you're equipped, and now you know when you hear it, you can set the record straight.
And knowing is half the battle.
That's right.
G.I. Joe. A Marvel Geeks. There
except,
you go.
Except that wasn't Malibu. That was Epic.
That's true. Well, yeah, it was.
What? Well, no.
Are you talking about G.I. Joe Extreme?
No, the original G.I. Joe. Wait, that wasn't Epic?
No, but it was Marvel. Original G.I. Joe was Marvel.
That's right. So it was Transformers.
Yep.
There you go.
So. Mm. Yep.
Well, again, thank you once again, Roland, for coming on.
Absolutely.
And
had a blast.
Well, thanks
for asking me.
I'm not a problem.
Thanks for accepting.
Well, I told Mike, I think over email, is that, you know, you just got to shut me up. You get me talking about comics. You know, obviously, I think you guys can tell, you know, I love comics still. You get me talking about comics, you got to shut me up. So anytime you want to let me ramble on, just let me know. I'll come back and I'll ramble anytime.
Definitely. Love to possibly get you back on for a book club discussion.
Oh, absolutely. That would be fun. Yeah, you have to give me the appropriate month to read mine too. So
sure,
you can't get me on and say, hey, we're talking about this one. You remember it from 35 years ago, don't you?
No, that's why I read it. So,
and I would have to search the boxes back there to find it. But
yeah, I love how earlier in the show you were talking about that one book, and you just looked around, boom, boom, boom. No, I don't have it. Now, folks, if you are listening to this in podcast form, so you cannot see what we are seeing with the screenshots of each other, this man behind him has, it looks to be at least 3 to 4 dozen boxes, just boxes of books. It's almost like he's sitting in a warehouse, and he just glances, one, boom, boom. No, I don't have that book.
It's like the Keymaster in the Matrix, but instead of TV screens, it's long boxes.
Yes. Yes.
See, even if that was my room, if I have that many boxes, I could not just go, look, boom, boom, boom. No, I don't have it. I would have to spend about 15, 20 minutes just looking through, say, nope, it's not here. Nope, it's not here. Nope, it's not here. I must not have it here.
See, I know. I guess it's the editor in me still that I just, you know, things need to be just so, you know, here, this needs to be here, because when I need to get to it, I need to get to it quickly, and right there it is, you know. I mean, you can't see my desk, obviously, but my desk is not, it's certainly not one of the cleanest desks that you could see, but it's an organized clutter.
Right.
I know where things are. It's just that, you know, it's a little pile. I got to get under this pile to get to it, but so I know where it is, but it looks a little messy.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you, and we definitely will have you on for a book, you know, the book club discussion. And
that sounds good. Sounds fun.
So. And so we're going to take a quick break here before we get into our picks of the week. And you're listening to, or you've been listening to, Mighty Marvel Geeks with Roland Mand as our special guest talking about the history of Malibu.
Hi, I'm Kylan from Mighty Marvel Geeks. We're trying to upgrade the above-ground underwater suborbital volcanic layer, and we need your help. Just check out the Patreon link on the Mighty Marvel Geeks page and see the swag you can get for supporting us. Who knows? Maybe the Colonel himself will give you a visit. Check us out at www.patreon.com/Mighty Marvel Geeks for more details, and thanks for listening.
And welcome back. Like I said, very short break this week. Wow, what can you say? History galore with Malibu.
This is going to be a giant-sized issue. And yes. If you're still listening at this point, congratulations. You win the Dogged Determination Gold Star of Approval this week.
If you're not still listening or not conscious, congratulations. The tryptophan's kicked in once again from Thanksgiving leftovers.
How many turkey sandwiches have you had?
Don't know.
Not near enough. For me, it's enough. The guys, for me, it's the turkey leg. Maybe it's because I've been to Disney World enough times to where I favor the big drumsticks that they serve there. But around my family, they know legs are mine.
See, I think this is life. This quote, this little soundbite, is the life after Thanksgiving.
I've been authorized by Director Fury to use any means necessary to keep you on premises. If you attempt to leave or play any games, I will tase you and watch Super Nanny while you drool into the carpet.
He didn't need a taser. All he needed was a drumstick or two.
Yep, yep. Pretty much.
Yep. So,
he can fry the turkey on the arc reactor in his chest. Hey, Pepper! Hey, Pepper, it's almost done.
You know, I thought we were having a moment.
I was having 12% of a moment.
There you go.
So, it is that time of the week, even on the holiday. It's time for the Marvel Unlimited pick of the week from Mighty Marvel Geeks.
Mighty Marvel Geeks Unlimited pick of the week. That's right, you just said that. I'm just repeating for dramatic effect. And if you remember, if you were paying attention earlier in the show, where our special guest Roland Mann was talking about going down to get comic books that cost only 35 cents a piece, well, this pick harkens back to that day. Because you look on the cover, and it's only cost 35 cents to get this. It was Star Wars number 12 from 1978, written by Archie Goodwin, penciled by Carmen Infantino, inked by Terry Austin. And I picked this one because it is one of the very first comic books that I remember having. Now, this is where Luke, R2, and 3PO crash land on a water planet. It's almost like a Kevin Costner movie,
Waterworld. Yeah.
And there are inhabitants on this Waterworld planet. They're descended from pirates. Their rule of thumb is they salvage any and all tech, any and all metal, scraps, anything like that, and they kill the survivors. Well, Luke only gets to live because he's the only one 3PO and R2 will work for. So, meanwhile, the pirates, they're duking it out with these, looks like scuba divers riding sea dragons. And above this planet comes in an Imperial Star Destroyer that has been hijacked by other pirates, led by the nefarious Crimson Jack, who, when Jason Aaron, writer of Star Wars, came on the show, I specifically requested that he try to bring back Captain Jack, just because he was one of my favorite bad guys.
And I went with the stupid route and asked for Jackson.
Well, I figured somebody else would ask for Jackson, too. I'm trying to be different. Besides, I did like Crimson Jack. But you can find this in Marvel Unlimited. It did come out in 1978, not too long after the first movie. And if you see the cover, you'll see that Luke is in his getup from Tatooine, where he got the like the white shirt and the beige pants. Yeah, he looks just like he stepped off the desert planet, and it's a hoot. He's from a desert planet. He's on a water world.
Wow. Well, I think it's almost that time. Actually, it is that time. Let's go. It is new comic book day picks of the week. This will be for December 2nd.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, Kylan, your first pick.
My first pick is a number one, Daredevil number one. The writer is Charles Soule. The penciler is Ron Garney. Back in black and on his home turf, Daredevil begins again in New York City as a new enemy emerges. Meanwhile, his alter ego, Matt Murdock, is on a new side of the law in the district attorney's office, fighting crime in the shadows, persecuting bad guys in the light. It's a whole new chapter for a man without fear, including the arrival of the devil's advocate. Welcome to hell, blind spot.
Good.
So, yeah.
So, Eric, your first pick.
My first pick is also a number one. It is Red Wolf number one. Written by Nathan Edmondson and penciled by Dalibor Talajic. I'll be honest, I have no idea how you pronounce it. But it looks very cool all the same. Once upon a Timely in the West, where frontier boomtown Timely has more than its share of scoundrels. Takes a hero to keep them in line. Red Wolf, the Cheyenne who crossed the desert and stood up to Mayor Wilson Fisk in Secret Wars' 1872, is the only man who can fill fallen Sheriff Steve Rogers' boots. As an outsider and an honest man, Red is going to need all his wits and both his fists to serve and protect. The tale of how Red Wolf wins the West starts in 1872 and will take him farther than he could ever imagine. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, my first pick of the week is a number two, and it is... It's going to be short because the write-up... of course, we know this is by Chip Zdarsky. Our world, plus a new Gwenpool story.
Gwenpool?
Yes.
Oh, my freaking goodness.
They have taken Gwen Stacy and turned her into a Deadpool. But the costume is, I believe, similar coloring to her Spider-Gwen costume.
Mm-hmm.
So... could we potentially see Gwenpool in the future? Because there was Gwenpool in issue one as well.
There you go.
So, I guess it's time for the number twos.
My number two is a number two. Nova number two. Cover artist is Humberto Ramos. Monsters, pancakes, mini golf. Sam Alexander is still getting used to having his dad back on Earth, but things are about to get a whole lot less stable when a surprising earthquake happens, or strikes. What's responsible for the catastrophic quake? If you guessed, a giant, awful monster that only Nova can stop? You're right. Plus, more about Jesse is revealed.
Okay. Eric, you're number two.
My number two is another number one, is Guardians of Infinity number one, written by Jason Latour and Dan Abnett, penciled by Carlo Barberi and Jim Chung. Who are the Guardians 1000? Well, defending the galaxy is a good gig, but Drax isn't thrilled with the combat hours, as in not enough of them, and Rocket isn't thrilled with the compensation, as in not enough of it. They're off on adventure to supplement both, and Groot is happy to come along. Why? Because he is Groot. But instead of the perks they want, they are about to get more trouble than they can handle. Good thing the Guardians 3000 are on hand to help. But what about the Guardians 1000? Also in this issue, Latour and Chung tell a one-off story of Ben Grimm and Rocket Raccoon stuck on a planet where culture is based on Earth-style professional wrestling. But the stakes are life and death. This ain't kayfabe, butter! Okay, I can't do a good Triple H. Don't call me brother.
I don't think that was really Triple H, though.
Or
are you trying to do Hogan?
I'm trying to do, like, any pro wrestler.
Oh, yeah. This is
they
Randy
all
Macho
do kind of sound like the sound.
This is Randy Macho Man Savage who played Bonesaw in Spider-Man. No?
That was actually pretty good.
Woo! That's all I got.
There's a reason we don't do a pro wrestling podcast, the three of us.
No.
Yeah. Listen here, brother.
Dead. Woo! Pool. No.
Listen here, brother. This is Deadpool Hogan. I want you to say your prayers, eat your vitamins.
Ooh, so what's your number two pick there, brother?
My number two pick is All New Inhumans, number one. Writers is Charles Soleil and James Asmus. Penciler is Stefano Casilli. As the Terrigen clouds move around the world, they leave in their wake the wrecked lives of inhumanized. Crystal and her team are tasked to help as many of these new humans as possible. That's N-U humans. But it's not going to be easy. Not only are the views of these new superpowered people varied, from fear to anger to amazement, but even those who get the powers aren't always glad to get them. Add to that the 19 mysterious sky spears that recently crashed into the Earth. And the inhuman world just got a lot more complicated.
Ooh.
So I love how they're kind of tying in the whole thing from S.H.I.E.L.D. With the Terrigen. Definitely looks like this is what's going to help start the end of the mutant life in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. Mm.
So our final picks of the week.
My final pick is Vision, number two. The writer is Tom King. The penciler is Gabriel Hernandez-Walta. Cover artist is Mike DeMundo. After the stunning, heart-stopping events of Vision, number one, the Avengers will never be the same. The Vision and his family attempt to cope with these events in their own unique way. Though they put on a happy face, each of them can feel their anger growing, blistering, tearing them apart. Will the Vision be able to hold together, or will that anger destroy them and the world around them? So, this looks like it's going to be a fun read.
I tell you what else is going to be a fun read. What? My number three pick is Doctor Strange, number three, written by our buddy Jason Aaron. Doctor Strange wakes up nearly naked with none of his magical tools or spell books and no memory of how he got there. Nor does he know where all the monsters chasing him came from.
See what happens when you go to Universal?
Uh-huh. I think somebody watched The Hangover before he had to meet a deadline.
I think so.
Is he missing a tooth and got a face tattoo?
I don't know. He might.
Is there a bloody giraffe sitting next to him?
Well, I will say that one of the monsters on the little preview cover does look a little bit like Mike Tyson.
Okay. Well, my final pick of the week is Spidey, number one. Writer is Robbie Thompson. Penciler and cover artist is Nick Breshaw. Think you know everything about Peter Parker's early days? Think again. It's action, adventure, and a rip-roaring romp in classic Marvel style as Spidey swings onto the shelves this winter. Featuring a rip-roaring romp through Malibu history. featuring adventures from throughout the web-slinging Wonder's younger years. It's a return to the days of overdue homework and not knowing how to talk to girls or anybody, really, and just plenty of danger. Witness some of Spidey's earliest tangles with the likes of Doc Ock, Sandman, and a host of other unexpected guests. So, I think that's going to conclude it for this week. It's
the giant-sized bonus issue.
It's that giant-sized, king-sized podcast only. And so, Jarvis, if you would, please.
All wrapped up here, sir. Will there be anything else?
Nope, just time to go dark.
Hey.
So, to get some of the info we got about Malibu, and get that clarification that you were talking about with the colorist.
Clarification.
Myth busted.
At least we'd be the cool kid to say, hey, we talked to the guy who was there when it happened, and so we know the truth.
Yep, like I said, myth busted.
This has been a Weeby Geeks production.
Did you know that you can shop and support the Weeby Geeks Network at the same time? Every time you use the Amazon link to make purchases, such as a set of CAD Sessions MH510 headphones to listen to the Weeby Geeks Network podcasts, a percentage of your purchase goes towards helping the network. So, to review, browse the page, click the link, shop, and repeat. Thanks, and keep listening.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Are you in the market for some new swag? Some comic-themed merch? How about a Sweetwater keychain of your favorite villain or vigilante? Just hop over to the Weeby Geeks site and click the Superhero Stuff link and let the retail therapy commence. Using the link helps support Weeby Geeks because they get a small commission from each sale at no extra cost to you. So get to shopping, and thanks for listening.